Hi, everybody. This is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks Podcast. Today is September the 3rd. Couple of announcements. Ooh, before we get started here, very important. I just want to say, if you've noticed some inconsistencies in the quality of our audio lately, I just want to remind people that I have been on the road, I've been experimenting with different microphones and setups, and a couple of the shows that you've heard were actually audio captured from Ustream video, so I've been dealing with some unfamiliar surroundings, and I know it's been maybe a little less than optimal, and I appreciate your patience. Also, I want to say thank you to a listener named Jeff who made me a very cool little animated graphic intro for our private school crest logo with the bird and the Trivium on it. And thanks one more time to Davy Barker for designing that logo for us originally. You will see that in upcoming School Sucks videos for sure. And I also want to say thank you to a listener named Jason for a very kind mailed donation all the way from Kansas. And that can't be easy to get mail to New England with all the tornadoes they have there. I mean, these things can pick up a house and transport it to an entirely different place, forcing the occupants to engage in all kinds of, unwanted adventures. I've never been to Kansas. Most of what I know about Kansas is from old films. So if there's any inaccuracy in what I've said, I apologize. All right, let's get started with today's show. What we're going to be doing here is something a little bit different. A series, but it's not going to be like a lot of the series we've done in the past. It's going to come all at once, and it's going to come in very small parts. Some of these shows will be less than 20 minutes long. And all of the shows in this series were inspired by my recent experience with and subsequent success after reading the book Getting Things Done by David Allen. I would also suggest, either before or after listening to this series, you check out the Tragedy and Hope History So It Doesn't Repeat interview with David Allen. It's about 80 minutes long, and it is very, very educational. Also, this series is not intended as a replacement for, absorbing and processing the material in that book for yourselves. As we're going to talk about, there are a variety of ways to consume it. There's an audiobook, there's a paperback that's probably pretty affordable, and there are lectures that you can also obtain, which present it in a slightly different format, but in the end, you capture the same necessary information. And even though I encourage people to consume this material for themselves, the function of the series will be not only to entice you, hopefully to motivate you to actually do this for yourselves, but also to obtain some basic principles and strategies that you can put into play in your lives immediately. You can start seeing positive results, and hopefully that will provide further motivation to do a deeper study on your own. On this show for a long time, we've talked about how to, if possible, escape school. We've also talked about how to, if necessary, survive school. But many of the people who are listening to School Sucks Podcast or watching our videos are people who have discovered this after being done with school, maybe after even being done with college. And if you're anything like me, you might have had that experience one day after graduating from high school where you look at yourself in the mirror in the morning and you say, "I ain't got no skills." That's the voice I use to talk to myself in my bathroom. You can do whatever you want in your own bathroom. But I think that we also need to continue to incorporate tools for better learning, because it's great that people discover this podcast or this message or messages like this, if it's coming from somewhere else, at any point in their lives, if it can have a positive effect. But I also hope that we're providing practical strategies for becoming better learners and better doers. So that's what we're shooting for here. Similar series will follow. But I think the best place to start today is where I would suspect a lot of people actually are. In the last couple weeks, a couple articles came to my attention. Both of them I read on lifehack.com, another website that I highly recommend. Just, you know, go and join their mailing list. Oh, by the way, we're going to mention a lot of like products in this series. None of them are sponsors, but these are things that I found to be helpful. So Lifehack, just, you know, it's a nice thing to see in your inbox every morning. And maybe there'll be something inspirational or immediately useful there. But I found both these articles, and even though they seemed different, they had a common theme that I felt was like a really important concept to clarify before moving forward with this series. We'll call it present moment awareness. So I'm going to read both articles, and then what will follow is an excerpt of a much larger conversation that I had with Richard Grove and Tony Myers, who will be included throughout this series. And I really value both Rich's and Tony's input in this series, as they are a little bit further along in understanding all of this than I am. But I will tell you that recognizing these issues and addressing them, even if I'm still technically in the beginning stages of where this can go, was so revolutionary in its impact, not just on productivity. The biggest dividends that have been paid so far are in my attitude and my serenity. That's how I feel right now. I feel relaxed, and I hope you find this useful as well. Hopefully the way that this is going to be presented maximizes its usefulness to you. The episodes, like I said, will be short. They'll probably come out every 2 or 3 days over the next couple weeks. Now, we have spent, oh gosh, I couldn't even tell you how many minutes or even hours devoted to the appreciation and the wonders of the human mind. But let's face it, frankly, there's certain things about these minds of ours that can kinda suck sometimes. So we'll start there. First piece I would like to share from lifehacker.com is called How Clutter Affects Your Brain and What You Can Do About It. It's written by Michael Cho, who is the founder of a web services agency. It matches up businesses with web design and development teams called Oomph. It begins. A few years ago, I worked at a web design agency as a product manager. The part of my job I loved the most was working on product with our design team and clients. Unfortunately, this was only about 10% of the work I actually got to do. The majority of the time, I was trying to control the constant flow of stuff, keeping track of meeting notes, searching for files, and trying to stay up to date with the latest technology news. I was mentally exhausted. I'd get home feeling that I hadn't really accomplished anything. Once I left the agency and started Oomph, I wanted to fix how I approached consumption in my life. Over the last few years, I've discovered ways to reduce the noise of stuff around me so I can focus on creation and have even more time to do the things that matter most. The last year has been the most productive of my life, and I owe a lot of it to understanding the importance of decreasing how much I consume and coming up with ways to cut clutter. New heading, How Clutter Happens. You collect things for a number of reasons. Maybe you think you'll use it later. It has sentimental value, or you spent good money on it and you feel you need to keep the item even though you haven't touched it in weeks, months, or years. You might be holding on to that book you bought a year ago that you swear you'll read, or that killer pair of shoes that you'll bring out for just the right occasion. But the reality is you probably made a mistake in buying those things, and it literally hurts your brain to come to terms with that fact. Researchers at Yale recently identified that two areas in your brain associated with pain, the anterior cingulate cortex and insula, light up in response to letting go of items you own and feel a connection towards. This is the same area of the brain that lights up when you feel physical pain from a paper cut or drinking coffee that's too hot. Your brain views the loss of one of your valued possessions as the same as something that causes you physical pain. And the more you've committed emotionally or financially to an item, the more you want to keep it around. New heading, why Apple wants you to touch their stuff. When it comes to physical things, merely touching an item can cause you to become more emotionally attached to it. In this study, researchers gave participants coffee mugs to touch and examine prior to participating in an auction. The researchers varied the amount of time the participants were able to handle the mugs to see if this would have an effect on the amount of money participants would be willing to spend on the mugs during the auction. The results of the study showed that participants who held the mugs longer were willing to pay over 60% more for the mugs than participants who held the mugs for shorter periods. The study concluded, the longer you touch an object, the greater the value you assign to it. Apple is familiar with the effect of touch on your psychology and has brilliantly designed its retail stores to help you build an emotional attachment to their products. Then it shows a shot of the Apple store, which you cannot see because this is audio, but trust me, in this picture, you can touch everything. Author Carmine Gallo is writing a book about the ins and outs of the Apple store. Gallo explains that everything in the Apple store is designed for you to touch and play with, to make you feel like it's your own. He states, quote, "The main reason notebook computer screens are slightly angled is to encourage customers to adjust the screen to their ideal viewing angle. The ownership experience is more important than a sale," unquote. Once you introduce new items into your life, you immediately associate value with these items, making it harder for you to give them up in the future. This psychological connection to things is what leads to the accumulation of stuff. Now, to pause for a minute, this is discussing physical stuff. But as this series goes on, we will also understand the impact of mental stuff. So make a note. New heading, clutter's impact on your brain. Whether it be your closet or office desk, excess things in your surroundings can have a negative impact on your ability to focus and process information. That's exactly what neuroscientists at Princeton University found when they looked at people's task performance in an organized versus disorganized environment. The results of the study show that physical clutter in your surroundings competes for your attention, resulting in decreased performance and increased stress. A team of UCLA researchers recently observed 32 Los Angeles families and found that all the mother's stress hormones spiked during the time they spent dealing with their belongings. Similar to what multitasking does to your brain, physical clutter overloads your senses, making you feel stressed, and it impairs your ability to think creatively. Clutter isn't just physical. Files on your computer, notifications from your Twitter and Facebook accounts, and anything that goes ping in the night competes for your attention. This creates a digital form of clutter that erodes your ability to focus and perform creative tasks. When you have to-do items constantly floating around in your head, or you hear a ping or a vibrate every few minutes from your phone, your brain doesn't get a chance to fully enter creative flow or process experiences. When your brain has too much on its plate, it splits its power up. The result, you become awful at filtering information, switching quickly between tasks, and keeping a strong working memory. The overconsumption of digital stuff has the same effect on your brain as physical clutter. New heading, finding your perfect storm. I like to keep things neat, but when I used to clean my room to perfection, my mom would still see the same room as a disaster. Everyone's tolerance for clutter is different. Researchers have even found that people need a bit of a mess in their surroundings to feel inspired and to get work done, stating that a clean desk can be seen as a dormant area, an indication that no thought or work is being undertaken. While clutter has been shown to negatively affect your performance, it is your perception of clutter that matters, not someone else's. If having a notebook, pen, or a photo of your significant other on your desk doesn't feel like clutter to you, then it's not. You should seek to create spaces that make you feel at ease. Final heading, editing the noise, 4 ways to master clutter. There are millions of sources of information and things for you to consume, so it's important to figure out a way to control these streams so you have more time to do things that matter. Here's 4 things that have been working for me. Number 1, apply constraints. One of the principles of good design is constraints. You can apply the same theory to create a system for mastering consumption. For instance, set a limit for how many people you follow on Twitter, how many books you buy, or how many apps you own. I set a limit of 200 people I follow on Twitter, and I don't buy books until I've finished reading the current book I'm reading. I also don't purchase or download any apps until I need them. there will always be more information available than you can consume. So set limits so you're no longer simply trying to just get through it all, but rather enjoying more of what you consume. 2, use small storage spaces. Cutting down on your storage space can do wonders for limiting consumption. Try cutting your closet down to 10 hangers or force yourself to use a small bag when you travel. Do you really need a walk-in closet or a rack for all your shoes? Try constraining your storage spaces and you'll quickly identify what you really need. 3, conduct a monthly review of your closet or whatever space you feel is most in need of reorganizing. Every month, review your closet looking for items you haven't worn. If it's summer and you have t-shirts, shorts, or shoes you aren't using, put them in a bag and sell them on eBay or Craigslist or give them away. Another option is to try and get rid of one item a week until you've cut your belongings down to the things you actually use. 4, remove all files from your desktop daily. Ooh. If you work on a computer, having a cluttered desktop every time you turn on the computer can give you a constant uneasy feeling. At the end of each day, remove every file from your desktop. If you don't have an immediate place to move the file, create one folder on your desktop and drop the stray files in there. Clutter, whether physical or digital, is something you'll always have to deal with, but it can be controlled. Finding ways to steer the streams of consumption in your favor will give you a sense of power and a freed mind, leaving room for you to create and experience life without constantly filling your cup to the top with someone else's sugar. The end. Now, before we move into the portion of the show with Rich and Tony, we are going to do some takeaways from both articles. But for now, we're going to move right on to the piece about worrying. This is called Worry is a Vicious Murderer by Daniel DiPiazza. I'm beginning to hate blogging. Not because I don't like writing or talking to people, but because every time I sit down to write something, I have to make a choice. I have to decide who I want to present myself as. With each word I write, I have to decide if I should be my real self, or if there's some enhanced internet Daniel that I should be more like. If there is, I have to figure out what the hell that guy would say. On top of all the other decisions I have to make every day, that's just tiring. Who's reading this? How do I sound to them? How do I want to sound? What will they think of me? And if they don't like what they read, will they stop reading? And honestly, I get worried. A lot. I get worried that people will read what I write and think I'm some prick. Fake, phony, bastard, snake oil salesman, internet sleazebag. Or I get worried that people will generally start to like me, and then I'll let them down somehow. I'm sick of worrying, and I don't want to worry anymore. The downside of having figured some things out, made some money, done some cool business things, and made some small achievements, is when you tell people the two or three things you figured out, they expect you to have answers to other problems, too. I don't have any answers. That also worries me. Am I supposed to have answers? Oh God, if I'm supposed to have answers at 25, I'm drastically behind. If someone were to ask me, are you a worrier, though? I'd probably say no, but I'd be lying. I worry about a million little things every day. Don't you? Sometimes we don't even realize what's going on while it's happening. Today I was at the gym working on my vertical jumps off those little teal and purple stackable step blocks, and there were two guys working out in the aerobics room on the heavy bags. As I kept stacking the blocks higher and higher, I was worried that I wouldn't be able to make the jump. I had this terrifying, completely vivid Blu-ray quality mental image of my clumsy toe catching on the blocks and sending them all crashing down, and I'd land in a horrifically twisted pile, writhing in agony. Then the guys would turn around and laugh at me. Or maybe they would just look in the mirror without turning around, shaking their heads and laughing at me. Or worst of all, maybe they would come and try to help me up. That would be completely emasculating. All of those scenarios, their outcomes, and the potential accompanying emotional states flew through my head in about 3 seconds before I attempted to make the jump, stacked 19 blocks high. and I couldn't do it. I just couldn't do it, man. I felt slow. I felt like there was a glassy haze over my senses. My brain was just too cluttered. I stood there frozen. All the spring was sapped from my calves. All my energy was drained. I was literally paralyzed. I made a couple of feeble attempts to get my spring back, but I just felt like my grandma trying to get out of her chair. Have you ever felt utterly paralyzed by worry? If there was some version of me that could have made the jump, some doppelganger out there in a parallel reality that had had the athleticism, another doppelganger might as well have put a gun to the first guy's head and blew his beautiful little brains all over the linoleum. I killed myself in 3 seconds with worry. Sometimes I wake up at 3 a.m. worried. Will my business keep going well? What if all my clients dry up and nobody wants to work with me? What if I can't feed myself? What if I make a stupid mistake and everything I've built gets torn down? One time I got in a fight with my girlfriend and she said that I, quote, wasn't even her type anyway. Was she saying that just to hurt me? What if I'm really not her type? Is she going to cheat on me? Is she already cheating on me? I think she likes dark guys. Should I start going to a tanning booth? Worries, worries, worries. Compound worries for the future with overanalysis of the past, and it leaves you precisely 0% of your mental capacity to seek opportunities and enhance your creative muscles in the present. Zero. Why are we even worrying so much anyway? What's there really to worry about? I don't know about you, but when I'm worried, I'm not at my best. I think when I'm worried, I actually get dumber. I haven't run any statistical tests to back this up, but I think if you were to take 2 IQ tests, one when I was fraught with worry and one when I was at, I don't know, say Disney World or something, you'd find that I am much smarter on Space Mountain. When I'm happy, when I'm not agonizing over the past or obsessing about the future, I actually make smarter, more insightful, more creative decisions. When I'm not worried about anything, I'm actually pretty brilliant. As entrepreneurs or aspiring entrepreneurs, we can't afford to get any dumber because we're worrying about things we can't control. To have clarity, to make smarter decisions, we have to stop worrying so much about the things that are outside of our locus of control. And instead, only focus on the things that we can control, period. We have to mentally clean house. Our brains are computers. When a computer has too many programs running in the background, it crashes. Let's sort things into 3 buckets. 1, things I can't control. 2, things I can control, but I'm choosing to let go of. And 3, things I can control and I'm going to act on immediately. Or I will add to this, plan to act on immediately in a systematic fashion. Notice how there's no 4th category that says things I can't control, but I'm still going to think about incessantly until I can find a way to control them, or if I really can't find a way to control them, spend energy being worried about the potential outcome. Most of us love this phantom 4th choice. Fuck that bastard. Banish him to Siberia. He's no longer an option. And while you're at it, banish the options in buckets 1 and 2 as well. Anything you can't control in bucket 1 gets the mental delete button. 99% of everything in the entire world falls into this bucket. What people think of you, the actions others take, the way people feel about the things you say or do, events that happen as a result of the things you can't control, delete, delete, delete. This isn't saying that you should be a thoughtless prick. Be kind to others. Do your best. But if that's not good enough, throw up your hands and be done with it. Some things you can control, but you should choose not to engage them. Just because you can make a choice doesn't mean you should. Sometimes the trade-off just isn't worth it. You could choose to continue a business or a personal relationship that causes you worry and anxiety. You could push through, but why? Delete. You could choose to continue a fruitless argument, but in the end, it won't make a difference whether you quote-unquote win or not. The damage is in the arguing, not the outcome. Just delete. I only want to deal with things in bucket 3, things I can immediately engage and have an impact on. If there's something I can do that will resolve the situation, or at least make a situation better, I want to do it immediately. Otherwise, I'm not going to let worry and clutter simmer in my subconscious and take up precious mental energy. This isn't the same as saying that I don't care about outcomes. I do. I've just come to realize that I rarely have the power to change the path of people or events in my life. So I do my best, then I just stop worrying about it, because worry has never helped me solve any of my toughest problems. And I'm only interested in being alive if I'm solving tough problems. Worry is a doppelganger that comes to murder our creative selves. So I'm just going to stop worrying. I'm done with it. What do you think? The end. Okay. When I first read both of these articles, I could identify with them quite a bit. But let's just go through each one briefly and talk about, what I think is important for our purposes here. First of all, the clutter article. The important points. Having clutter in your physical surroundings creates competition for your attention and makes you less efficient, and also gives you more encouragement to procrastinate because of all these different things that you can get into. Now, what's going on our computers is this problem on steroids. I can't tell you how many times I've been working on a video or a podcast, and I have to switch back to my web browser, and I've had Facebook open, and that's probably changed since the last time I was there, so I'll just take a peek and completely lose sight of what I'm doing. It's almost embarrassing to admit this, but it happens and has happened. I keep Facebook closed these days. That is a positive reinforcement schedule, to use some behaviorism lingo, in which I'm trying to participate on the most minimal level possible right now. Really, only out of necessity am I going to Facebook, because I have to check messages and update the School Sucks page, et cetera, et cetera. And even that is dangerous. And from my own experience, procrastination has a way of turning into resignation, right? If we procrastinate long enough, the urgency or the creative spark or inspiration that we initially felt about doing something, it dissipates. Now, if I'd had a system, the energy that I wind up expending rationalizing something not getting done, that energy could have been reallocated to doing it if I had a better capture and processing method to deal with that idea or that project when it initially struck me. And there's a bigger problem here as well. The Clutter article also talks about the Apple Store and the emotional impact of touching things. Well, when we have these projects or ideas that we don't move forward with, we've touched them emotionally. You know, maybe we've even started planning, but then we don't deliver. And this could be something very simple. It could be something complex. It could be some kind of life goal, right? So it's very scalable. I think that also sends us subtle messages, right? About one of Nathaniel Brandon's six pillars of self-esteem, personal integrity, right? If we're making these promises to ourselves and then not delivering, that gnaws at us. But let's talk just a little bit more about the psychology of the Apple Store, right? They want products to be touched so this emotional attachment can be formed, right? And we're forming that, this is what I said about personal integrity. We're forming an emotional attachment to ideas as well, especially if we think of something we want to do, and then we start planning it, and then we just never deliver it. So we're cluttering up our minds by, I would say, to involve some trivium language in this, doing the grammar without the logic. So let's start in the Apple Store. We go up, we say, "Ooh, this is an iPad. I want it." Right? So we've identified it and then made some kind of very quick emotional evaluation of that situation, but we haven't said, "Well, you know, where does it go? What is it needed for? How will I use it?" All of those questions that are more about the logic or the processing of that situation. So by starting something and then not finishing it, we create what will be referred to from this point on in the series, the term that David Allen uses in the book Getting Things Done, an open loop. If we want to use input processing and output, we've accepted an input and then not done the next steps. Or if we want to use the trivium, we've created some new grammar for ourselves, but then not done the logic or the rhetoric. if we just have stuff that's completely unidentified surrounding us or floating around in our minds, that's very chaotic. But if you don't have a system in place, it really doesn't matter if you're identifying things. This is an iPad. That's a stack of papers. If you then don't have a way to make sense of it. So capture itself, just capturing all this stuff and identifying it, is kind of useless if you don't have a process that can take off from there. And moving into the worry article, yeah, it's great to have a bucket that you can put these things into, but what's next? Things can't just sit in a bucket. There needs to be a next step in that process. The worry article reiterates this idea of too many things going on in the background, right? And the uneasy feeling that that creates. Like, so he says your mind is like a computer. If you have too many things running, it will crash. But what is that crash? What does it look like? Well, I think it's different for all of us, right? My crash, quote unquote, might not look like yours. You might not even have one. For me, I think it's this. I think it's an apology that I owe to quite a few people. And I would describe it as there's all these situations in the past, right? And they range from the romantic to the professional, where I was not giving the person or the situation the attention that it deserved in the moment, in the now, because my mind, my focus, was divided into too many smaller parts. Not intentionally, right? Not like, oh, look at me, I'm a really good multitasker. Multitasking is what happens if we don't have a system in place to be productive with a certain project or a certain action in the moment. The past and the future each have a tremendous amount of emotional gravity that can pull our attention, that needs to be in the present, away from the present, in both directions. My lack of focus, my lack of presence with people and situations in the past is the result of, first of all, collecting too many things from my past, not knowing what to do with them, and then, of course, the anxiety about the future, about how those open loops would one day be closed.
So it's not all happening consciously, but it's happening. I sent you two articles. The first one was called Worry is a Vicious Murderer. And the second one was called What Clutter Does to Your Brain and What You Can Do About It. And I think that these two articles, while they overlapped as far as what they talked about with a lot of the stuff that we've been talking about, they also have that common theme. In the case of the worry article, that person is not in the present moment. They're directing their energy and attention into the future. And in the clutter example, you know, all this stuff has gathered up and I don't want to let go and I might need this someday. That person is directing all their energy and focus into the past.
It's about energy. That's fascinating. Energy and time. How are they related?
Both of these states are about not being where you need to be. The only place there you can be to be productive in your life, which is right now.
Yes, right now. Well, the idea is, with both articles, the main focus is their attention, especially their emotional energy, is being directed in other areas. And that can become somewhat habitually addictive. Getting into a situation, we constantly worry about future events, or we constantly worry about what happened in the past and not letting go of that, or just having too much clutter and having the inability to emotionally let go of objects. The inability to really observe those emotions, what's causing them, and try to take constructive actions to change them. And that's why Rich and I were talking earlier today, you know, there's more than one day. Right. In a lifetime. So, and you know, it's not going to,
you can't get it done all in one day,
but you can start taking the steps to overcome those old habits. And so there's two main properties here. One is just the basic method. The other one's the habitual change that comes with it. And, you know, that takes time, but it's also like, once you just start doing little things, you'll start to notice a lot more time for yourself. You're managing things. And all of a sudden it's really the mental clarity that comes and the sort of emotional attachment you have from things that used to cause you a lot of worry, a lot of stress, a lot of anxiety. I know for myself, when I started employing the method, I was helping you out. I was helping to build, you know, we built the studio together. And I could not have helped you in that endeavor, trying to work, you know, with my father in the small business we run and helping you guys out at the same time. So having that method available to us has made a massive difference, especially in my anxiety and my stress level at that time. And it just helped organize things and help keep things in a situation where I knew what needed to be done and what I can, you know, put off. And just being able to name it and categorize it made all the difference. That simple.
What's the importance of identifying your stuff?
Well, it's the importance of observation. I mean, first of all, we observe something, right? We take in something from the environment. Oh, touch the computer. Oh, I just named it, right? Just the mind itself, the thing it naturally does is just process information. We love to be inundated with information. That's why we, like David Allen said, we love being in nature. There's just so much information. When we name it, our mind naturally, instantly processes it. But when we have all this clutter.
Let's start with your first observation. What did you do? You went and you physically picked it up, right? You touched it. And this ties back into one of the articles that we had to read for homework at the Apple Store, how it's all set up to, once you touch something, then you're identifying with it. Mm-hmm. You don't become it, but you're observing it at a closer level.
Yes.
It's within arm's reach. You know, you're making contact. You're getting a sense of tactile, you know, what's it feel like? What's it weigh? How's it balance? These sort of things, right? And so what you end up getting is, it's a chain reaction, really. It's a natural chain reaction that we've had since we're children. When you're like 2 years old, you pick up everything and you test it for food. Is this food? Is this food? Is it people yelling at you? Is this food? You know, no, it's not food, right? And that continues on. So when you pick up something and you actually have it in your hand and you're starting to form a habit to put in your pocket, that's one thing. When you're inspecting your stuff, what is stuff? Let's just define stuff. Stuff is things that you haven't picked up in a while, that it's nebulous and ambiguous in your mind. And you go over in your office or your workspace or your home space and you say, you know, okay, I got a messy garage. You can't just put clean garage on your list.
No.
There might be some things you need to clean the garage. You might want to get some, you know, a vacuum, you know, this sort of thing. You might have some stuff to get rid of. So you're going to have to go through your garage and you do it like, you know, I do it clockwise or counterclockwise, work yourself around the room and you pick everything up. What is it? Is this where it goes forever? Or do I need to put it someplace else? Do I need it at all? Is it something I need to file for reference? Is it something I need to take action on? If so, can I do it in 2 minutes? If not, I need to schedule an appointment and make a project out of it. A project is anything with more than three steps.
Sure.
That you can't do in less than 2 minutes. And so you go around, and by the end of the day, it's like, okay, I need to get gas for the lawnmower. I need to put air in the tires. I need to do these different things. Oh, and in order to do that, I have to charge the battery for the air compressor because it doesn't, you know, it's not an electric air compressor. So there's all these different things. That's all in your mental RAM, subconsciously, because you know you have a dirty garage. And all those steps to get it resolved are either, you know, undefined or ambiguous. And once you make them specific and you write them out, then it's easy to get them done because now you're just collecting check marks. You're just cranking widgets, doing the same process of, you know, getting things done.
There's an emotional component to that as well. Yeah. And they talk about this in the Worry article when he's talking about putting things in buckets.
Sure.
Right. So that's a helpful visualization. I mean, no matter how much you train yourself to carry water, you know, there's only so much of it that you could possibly carry in your arms. So the idea of putting things where they need to go. And, you know, the buckets that he talks about as far as like taking all this storm and stress that's going on in your mind and saying, okay, these are the things that I can't control.
Mm.
So dump things that I can control, but I'm letting go of. And the third one is things that I can control and will act on immediately, which I think might also be setting yourself up for failure because everything that comes into your consciousness of, well, that's something that I should deal with. You can't act on immediately. So GTD or getting things done could be brought into this at this point. If you can do it in 2 minutes, you should do it.
Sure.
But even if you can't do it in 2 minutes, you can still find a place for it to go so it's not gnawing at your conscious mind.
And there's this concept that, you know, to throw in the contrast called serenity through force. Mm-hmm. And what we're talking about is really a peaceful way to go about getting our life in order, getting our emotional selves in order, and letting that anxiety go. But the serenity through force comes when we get to the point where we just can't take it. Our office is so cluttered. We have so many things to do. Like you mentioned yesterday, you know, you had 7 things to do, and it kind of lay nagging on you until you got to the point where it's like, I got to actually do something. You become sort of
doing something makes you feel better than not doing something.
Right, exactly. And you're kind of forced into it rather than kind of recognizing it for yourself. Because what you mentioned earlier is that what all these methods that we present, like let's say nonviolent communication or the trivium or even getting things done, the key thing is observation and naming it, identifying it. And what you mentioned with the same 3 steps. And so what's interesting about what he did to off put all that stress was, you know, what the things he can control, he acknowledged it. He, in a way, observed it and maybe gave it a name. I'm not quite sure, but he at least observed it, and you know, it was immediately recognized in his consciousness. And then he took the next step and realized this is what I can control. Or maybe this is not as important. Well, but that's like really the key.
It's the prayer of serenity by Reinhold Niebuhr recognize what you can't control and what you can control, and to distinguish between the two and work on the one you can control. And that's the simplest
version of that without involving God, just as something you can say to God, if you believe in God, or to yourself, is grant me the serenity. Because there is a book called The Power of Your Subconscious Mind that talks about prayer as communicating with the subconscious. So however you do it, whatever you believe,
first off,
I'll say that
the prayer of serenity that most people have heard is very short
compared to the whole prayer.
Well, it's an edited version.
Absolutely.
And that the other version, the original version, is the words are different.
Mm.
It has a different meaning. It pertains to existential reality, things that exist objectively. The truth applies to everyone. Not just some people, and if you believe that doesn't apply to you, you know, that sort of thing.
Well, let me tell people what it is, because some people don't even know. Go ahead and Google Serenity Prayer Full. This is my first, folks, in the history of School Sucks podcast, my first prayer recommendation. But the short version of the prayer is, grant me the serenity to accept the things that I cannot change, the courage to change the things that I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And I think that might have more to do with our emotions and our longing for the past or our concerns about the future than maybe the productivity angle. But it obviously, like Tony just said, it all relates together, where it's all the same concept.
I don't want to say it's difficult. It just takes time to inculcate that habit, to have, you know, what a friend of mine would always say, prudent judgment, to be able to, you know,
prudent judgment.
It's just the ability to take in enough from your environment and actually make a choice. You know, we have free will. We have the ability to make choices. We have the ability to question things. And that's really all this is. It's engaging your consciousness. It's simple. Yeah, we don't think about doing it across the board, you know, on all scales and all levels. And that's really the difference. Where all these different methods, like getting things done, is applied to a sort of business perspective, right?
Mm-hmm.
A business environment. The Trivium was implied maybe to a more of a philosophical endeavor.
Or homeschooling.
It's an educational
Method. NVC.
NVC is more for your own personal observation
relations.
Of your motive.
conflict resolution. Right? But these are all interpersonal skills that should be in our toolbox. We should know how to communicate without using the language of obligation. We should be able to learn how to learn anything. And we should be able to learn how to get things done. And it's all observation using your five perceptive skills. Input, processing, and output. The input, pick it up, ask what it is, where does it go, and that's your input. The logic is this something that I have to do something else with? Do I have to schedule an appointment? Is there any follow-up? And the rhetoric is you feel serene because that thing is in its place and it's taken care of, or it's filed, or it's thrown away, or it's scheduled, or it's in process, and all you have to do is look at the next action.
All right, so I thought we could conclude today with just a few suggestions. If you feel like this is relevant, I mean, you might be like, hey, Brett, look, I'm a laser-focused kind of guy or gal. This is old news. Well, you certainly know somebody who is disorganized, because I think most people kind of are. You know, and even if they can keep a clean desk or, you know, my car is immaculate, right? And I always try to keep my car and my room and my office clean, but that wasn't reflecting what was going on in that little head of mine. I'll tell you what. So we know a disorganized person. Consider sharing it with somebody else. You can send them this MP3. And really, what I wanted to include at the end of the show, wherever possible in this series, is just a few small suggestions. Because what's really important is meaningful habit change starts with small steps, things that seem easy to do. So here are some things. We'll start with easiest, and we'll go to slightly more advanced. First thing that I did was I removed Facebook, the little Facebook icon from my Firefox toolbar, making it less accessible. So in other words, I've inserted additional steps to keep me away from Facebook. If Facebook is not, you know, the site that's eating up a lot of your present moment focus or awareness, you know, Twitter, whatever, try doing the same thing. Try it for a week. See what it changes. See how much more time is made available to you. I found that this seemed to free up quite a bit of my time, because I start unconsciously scrolling through the news feed and looking for things and telling myself stories that I'm doing research for show prep. And, you know, I've got all these great friends and I've blocked all these people from high school who post pictures of their kids. So I'm only seeing the most relevant things going on in the world. Unfortunately, so much of what is passing in front of my eyes is not actionable, right? And that creates, I think, uneasiness and stress for me anyway. So whatever that is for you, give that a try. That's a simple one. Second thing I did was the desktop of my computer. It was a mess, a disaster. I took the Getting Things Done flowchart, and if you just do a Google image search for Getting Things Done flowchart, you can find a version of this. So I took the photo that I found, and I saved it. And then I made a new project in Photoshop. And you could use, there's a Microsoft program from the 1970s called Paint. Or there's also, I think there's a program called Paint.net. And I know there's probably a pretty decent equivalent for Apple. Some like free Photoshop kind of thing. But I use Photoshop. I made a new file, 1600 by 900, the size of the desktop on my laptop. And putting the flowchart in the middle, I made a guide for how I wanted my desktop to be organized. If you don't have time to do this, you could even go and Google like desktop organizer wallpaper, and it'll give you a bunch of options. There's a cool one that makes it look like an office where you can put things on shelves and stuff. There's a desk where you can put, you know, certain icons on there. But I wanted to make my own because I needed something that I could customize to my schedule and my projects and, you know, where my focus goes. So I'll put a picture of what I made in the show notes for today's episode. But I put the Getting Things Done flowchart in the middle. And then on the left side, I just have, you know, current audio projects, current video projects, and collaborations. And there's a box for each one that all the icons that are relevant get organized into those boxes. At the top, I have a big box called New. When something comes onto my desktop and it is new, it goes in this box until I can decide where it needs to go. But there's also a lot of stuff that isn't actionable that I need to keep, and I call this reference. I learned that from the book Getting Things Done. So I have one box called on the right side, on the other side of the flowchart, called SSP Reference, where I keep, you know, the things that keep reoccurring in the shows, like the bell is in a folder called SSP Audio. But then I have things like, you know, website, pictures, Ustream, documents. And then I have a personal and professional section, which is for like tutoring or, you know, calendar, things that are personal, things that deal with me. This has been very helpful, and it's been a pretty easy system to commit to. Right now, we use calendars, right? Like, people are like, what are you, just some nitwit, willy-nilly going about life, not any kind of organization system, period? No, I have a Google Calendar. It's color-coded for everything that goes on in my life. I have to-do lists. What I've always been missing is a system that integrates everything. And that system being able to spread across everything that I do and every space that I occupy, whether it's virtual or in the real world. And that's what I'm trying to create for myself now. So I see the desktop of my computer a lot. And to have it set up like this is a reminder. I'm trying to follow this system. I'm trying to be organized. When my desktop looks like this, I feel better. Where else can this, in my life, translate? That sentence could have been said better. I'm going to move on. I've been working on this stuff for a while, folks. I'm looking forward to getting it out. So, excuse me. Third thing. My email. Holy shit. Let me tell you about this. I have two email accounts. One is a Gmail account that I use for personal, like communicating with family, for tutoring, and for anything related to the domain name schoolsucksproject.com. I have another email, brett@edulution.com, which is still tied to School Sucks Podcast because when I set up the site initially, that was the domain name. So all the PayPal stuff, all the Podomatic stuff goes through this other email address. Well, hundreds of emails pour into this. Well, I'll say over 1,000 emails pour into those sites every week. And it's not all like, oh, Brett, we, you know, love the show. You know, oh, Brett, here's money. It's mostly things that are not actionable. I get an email every time somebody registers an account at schoolsucksproject.com. As we've had the spammer problem lately, that has been quite a bulk of what I've been receiving. The Yahoo account
every time a payment comes in. What I've accumulated was thousands, thousands, over 10,000 emails, if I add both accounts together, of things that were just sitting in IN. And this is not bringing about serenity in any way, because this is IN. In other words, these are things that I was supposed to deal with or put somewhere that were never dealt with or put anywhere. So I cleaned them both all out. I got both of my INs to empty. And this is a theme that's going to be recurring in this series. Getting your inbox, the stuff that you have to do, to empty. And it doesn't mean that everything has been acted on and everything has been completed. It's just, it's not gnawing at you anymore because it has a place that it goes and you put it there. And then the system is deciding what to do next, right? What the next actions are. We're going to get into all this. But cleaning both those out, getting both of those inboxes to empty, brought this sigh of relief that I was just like, yeah, this is something I got to do. It's no big deal. There shouldn't be this much stuff. When it was done, I felt really good. So all three of those things are some of the things that I've done. Small things to change big habits. I hope this is helpful. There's more things I could suggest about present moment awareness. I really suggest you check out the work of Daniel Siegel and his website and his project and the term he coined called Mindsight. And if you are into meditation, if you have any experience with this, I suggest you go through a meditation. You could probably even find a guided version of it on YouTube called The Wheel of Awareness. And while our attention is torn away from the present, into the past, or into worries about the future, we're missing, obviously, a tremendous amount of opportunities. So what Siegel does is he walks you through this process of being more in tune with what's going on in you and beyond you right now. I think it takes about a half an hour. I did it a couple times, and it was nice, you know? A lot going on in me. So I hope you find these suggestions helpful. I hope you stick with us through the entirety of this series, and I certainly look forward to your feedback and any suggestions that you have. All right, mwah, have a good day.
On the town.